Okay, the project part three has been made available. I assume you got the email. The only difference this time is you would do one task for sure. That's the k-means clustering over the search results. That's a required task. And then the other required task, you have a whole bunch of choice. So you can choose any one of these or make up your own task. Okay, and so you can improve your, I mean basically this is a project that's been built on from last two parts to the third part. Now you're actually doing result clustering, but you can also, half of this project is you can make up, you can either pick one of these tasks or make up your own task and do it with respect to this project. So that's basically the way it's set. And then, I guess for the extra credit, if you wanted extra credit, you just pick one more of these and then do that too. And then the demo, even though the demo is being listed here, it's not really the case that demo is part of project three. Demo is really for all three projects together. Okay, and then you will have a separate credit for the demo. And normally what we would do is you add up the project 1, 2, 3 marks and the demo marks. So you can think of, if you haven't completed some parts of project 1 and 2 and so didn't get as many points as you thought you should get, by the time of demo, if you have completed them, you know, essentially you count that again. So that's how you, it gets taken care of to some extent. Yes?
Will the extra credit project carry over to other things, or is it just for projects?
Okay, so nobody ever asked me what extra credit is, and I let it go because people just somehow like to do extra credit, I thought. But and I don't know what the extra credit is for. I have to, now that you asked me, I have to think about it. But actually, I do have an answer. The way I do it is that the extra credit points are all kept completely separate. The way it should be done is people who chose not to do extra credit should not be penalized. So the curve should not be bent by the people who did a lot more extra credit. Okay. So what I try to do is I, to the extent I can, I'll make up the grade cutoffs without looking at the extra credit, and then the extra credit points will just probably push you to a higher grade if possible. So that's the way it is. And all the extra credit marks are just added up and they look like, you know, marks in the bank. Okay. And there's a very complex weighting scheme. So if you get 10 extra points on, you know, out of, on a project part 2, which is over 60 points, then you got 10 over 60 extra points on that project, and that project might actually be only 0.05 of the, I mean 5% of your grade, so you then multiply that by 5% and then add them all up. Okay. I normally find that extra credit has this very Pareto, rich get richer kind of a feel to it. It's, I mean, I've been doing this forever, and I'm still to see people who need the extra credit having it. People who don't need it seem to have it. You know, so it's not that I'm making it that way, but I mean, people who are doing fine enough in the project probably feel like doing more stuff on it. And so even though it's meant for people to kind of make up, it doesn't always happen that way. Yeah, so that's the demo. You will see, show all three parts to the TA on the week of May 4th. He will set out like he'll give up a sign up sheet, and you sign up for a 15 minute demo, and then you just have to show everything working. And so he has like a big list of things. This is working, this is working, this is working, and then they'll just add up for the points. Okay. Any questions? Okay. Which list? His list would be all the projects are working. That's what his list would be. Yeah, I mean, when he has it, he can send it to you, but, you know, I think that's what it would be. Okay, all pieces are working. Okay. Yeah, the other thing is there will be an extra homework that would essentially, there'll be one more homework, it'll be a PAT homework because it will include the clustering, the classification and everything else that's being done, you know, and I think because of the timing, I will just probably make it due on the last day of the class. I'll keep adding questions to this homework and it'll all be due on the last day of the class. So don't be surprised that, oh my God, everything is due on the last day. I'm telling you now, as soon as the questions are available, if you have any gumption, start working on them. You know, there is nothing I can do. I can't extend the semester. Okay. So that's how it's going to be. What? I haven't decided, but even if it is cumulative, it will have a higher percentage, have a higher weightage for the stuff that hasn't been tested on already. Okay? Okay. So, we were doing classification learning last time, and basically, very quickly, to review something that we already said last time, we're given labeled examples of a concept, and then we just are given test cases. When we're given test cases, we are supposed to predict their labels. Okay, that was the point. And of course, there are lots of uses for classification in this course. In particular, we are interested in text classification in today's class, and by the either towards the end of today's class or next class, we'll also look at general classification. May not be text-based because content-based filtering is a recommendation system where people, Amazon will tell you, you might be interested in this other book because you have bought these other books before. Okay, and that can be done, that too is sort of text-based to some extent because there's a text-based description of the book information. And so, in fact, we will be looking at classification tasks from the text where we assume that the data points are text documents. Okay, so you could do all sorts of examples of applications here, you know, checking spam mails, whether given an article, checking which particular group is it likely to be from. Given an article, can you tell whether it's from New York Times or Arizona Republic, for example? Okay, if I give you enough articles from New York Times and Arizona Republic as training cases up front, then if I give you a new article, can you tell whether it's from New York Times or Arizona Republic? Okay, more, of course, this is, I guess, the mother of all applications. Given an article, given a document, is this likely to be relevant to the user or not, based on what the user has said is, the examples that the user has given as relevant versus irrelevant documents for a particular query, okay? We started talking about relevance feedback last time, and we'll talk about it again here today, I mean, very quickly. Then, in fact, another interesting example of text classification which we saw was in focused crawling, where you are trying to crawl the pages that are going to be relevant to a particular topic. Remember when we were talking about crawling, I said, if you are trying to build a vertical search engine just for yourself, if Google is trying to make like a bicycle search engine, then it can always just take its overall crawl and then just remove all the non-bicycle pages, okay? If on the other hand, you are looking for generating a crawl of all the bicycle-related pages, then you are interested in figuring out whether or not it's worth crawling a page. In particular, I have a page here, I have a bunch of links from this page. Should these links be followed or not? Do you think these links are likely to send you to bicycle-oriented pages or not, or topic-relevant pages? Okay, and then of course, this one is recommendation systems. Is this book relevant to the user? Okay, when we get to the recommendation systems, we will talk about two different ideas, content-based, which is using the description of the book, you know, deciding whether or not it's going to be relevant to the user. And then collaborative filtering, where using the fact that people who have bought the same kinds of books as this user also have bought this book. So maybe this user also would be interested in buying it, just to keep up with the Joneses. Okay, so we'll look at that later on. But so that's a different kind of a classification task, but here it is, you know, we are looking for content-based one. Yes. It's association between user, so basically we'll get to it, you know, next class, but just as you have term document matrix, you can have user item matrix, you know, the users and which items they have bought. And based on that, you are essentially trying to figure out similarity between two documents based on similarity between the keywords that are present in them. Similarly, you figure out in the collaborative filtering similarity between two users based on the items they have purchased. Okay, and then the extra step is, now if this user has is deciding whether or not to purchase an item, a particular keyword, in our analogy, you would say, well, you might likely want to have it because the other users who are close to you seem to have it already. Okay, and then we'll actually talk, when we get to recommendation systems, we'll talk about how to combine content-based and collaborative filtering systems. Okay, that's also possible. But right now we are talking about classification, which, you know, text classification. And then when we came to classification from clustering, it looked like it's just the same problem with more information. Previously we were just given data and we weren't told what clusters were, and we had to find clusters previously. Now we are already being told, not only are being given the data, but we are also being told, you know, for a subset of the data, this is label one, this is label two. So then all the data corresponding to label one become one cluster, all the data belonging to label two become another cluster. And then the classification problem now is a very simple idea, you know, from this point of view, which is, given a new point, which cluster is it closest to? Okay, then you can decide how to decide whether or not a point is close to a cluster in multiple ways. You can compare, you know, its distance to the centroid of the clusters. You can also consider, for example, comparing it to, you know, finding its k nearest neighbors from all the clusters together and seeing what's the majority label of these neighbors. Okay, these will have different, you know, advantages based on the shapes of the clusters. Shapes of the clusters. So for example, if you have two clusters more or less kind of equidistant, you know, they're small clusters and your distance between them, you know, you are here, let's say, you could just consider your distance to this and this centroid, okay, and the centroidal distance. Whereas if you are in a situation where here is another one cluster and here's another cluster, let's say, and you might be asking yourself, if you are a new point here, then you consider your k nearest neighbors and see majority of them, are they coming from the green side or the blue side? Based on that, you decide which cluster, you know, you belong to. And then whichever cluster you belong to, then that's the label you get. Okay? So this was a simple idea, I mean, basically a simple extension of, in fact, classification becomes an easier case than clustering. And then we talked about some specific ideas, relevance feedback, for example, that we talked about last time, essentially says, this is with respect to the text search. If I were to, so remember that the user was giving a query, and you didn't quite know whether the, you know, previously you were looking at the distance between the query and the documents. And we all knew that the query doesn't really represent the user's information need. Okay, because what ultimately matters is what the user says. Okay, so now instead of looking at the query, if in fact the user said, okay, look, here are some documents I like, here are some documents I don't like, then I could actually have decided, given a new document, whether or not it's going to be relevant to the user. Okay, normally when they give the query, they only have the query. But after you show the user the first 10 documents, and if they click on some of them, that means they kind of like them, let's say. And the ones that they didn't click on, they didn't like them. So after the first 10 pages have been shown, now you actually have not just the query, but also more information about which particular pages the user found relevant and which they didn't find relevant. Okay, now in that case, when I'm going to get the next 10 pages, should I just do what I was doing before and, you know, just run the same query and get the next 10 pages, or should I change the query? And the idea of relevance feedback is that you should change the query such that it is closer to the ones that the user sort of indicated are relevant, and farther away from the ones that are that the user say indicated is irrelevant. Yes.
How often does it happen where someone will search for So does relevance feedback, would it factor that in? So if someone changes their search, it's now searching with a new relevance, like trying to find.
That's a good point. I mean, so if you change, if you start over with a new query, then obviously in the normal assumption of relevance feedback is you gave the query, you looked at the first 10 results and gave some feedback. Based on that, the next 10 results will be shown to you, which maybe are more relevant to you than in the first 10 results. Okay. Now, obviously, as interesting as relevance feedback looks in theory, there are very few search engines which actually directly use relevance feedback, because the problem becomes, how do we actually get, I mean, apart from what you are saying, which is people just look at the top 10 without even clicking, they just say, this is not what I was looking for, and change the query. So there really wasn't any space for relevance feedback. Okay? Another issue is, in fact, in what I just said, is how do you actually know that the user liked the page? How do you, the search engine, know that the user liked the page? The normal relevance feedback model requires the user to declare that of these 10 pages, these are relevant, these are irrelevant. But nobody does that. So instead, what they do is they'll click on a page, and then so you are hoping that unintrusively, I mean, without being particularly intrusive, you want to get indirect feedback from the user. If they are staring at a particular page more, then maybe they like that page more. If they clicked on it, that means they may like it even more. But of course, it's also possible that they clicked on it, they opened it, and they came back. That means maybe they didn't like it. Do you see what I'm saying? In general, eliciting feedback from the users without basically asking them 20 questions all the time is a big issue. And what you really have to do is, actually, I think in the studies on the quote-unquote practical relevance feedback systems that are out there, they basically put a little camera which looks at your gaze on the search engine, on the search results, and sees which one are you looking at more longingly than the other one. Okay? But here, you know, we'll take all those things out of the context and say, let's assume that they actually gave us what is relevant, what is irrelevant. In fact, these kinds of, you know, if the users gave wrong feedback, or at least you interpreted the feedback wrongly, that's still par for the course for classification techniques, where in some sense the labels were noisy. You know, basically I just said, oh, this is the good examples, these are a bad example, but I made some mistakes. The some of the ones that I said are good examples are not good examples. Some of the ones I said were bad examples are not bad examples. So that means the teacher can actually be noisy. Okay? So, you know, we'll worry about that, but first now we'll assume that this is actually the relevance information that is given by the user is correct. In that case, the idea is, if the user were to have given exactly among the entire corpus, think of this silly idea. The first the user gives the query queue, then you just show the user the entire corpus of all 8 billion documents, okay, and ask them, tell me which of these do you like with respect to your query, which ones you don't like. And they had nothing else to do, so they actually go and say, these half a billion documents I like, these 7.5 billion documents I don't like. Okay, then I can just take the query, throw it out the window, because the query was just a conversation starter. I know much more about what you really want at this point of time. So if I were to now send the perfect query, that perfect query would essentially be the centroid of the centroid vector of the relevant documents minus the centroid vector of the irrelevant documents. Do you understand what I'm saying? In this case, the original query can be thrown out the window. This would be the optimal query. If you sent this and this was run on the 8 billion documents, then in some sense you would have gotten the results. Top 10 results will be the most relevant results to the user. But obviously, this is a useless exercise, because it's expecting the user to first look at all 8 billion documents already and then redoing it. However, this gives you the idea as to what you need to do. If you were only given top 10 results, user only was shown the top 10 pages, and they said, here are the relevant ones, here are the irrelevant ones in the top 10, then rather than just be too rash and shift over from the original query to just the query, So for example, if you only have top 10, then you can compute this optimal query with respect to just the top 10 results. I mean, the top 10 results, which ones he said was irrelevant and which ones he said was relevant. Except 10 is too small a sample. So what you really want to do is, this is estimate of the optimal query, there is still the original query, and these are two vectors. I just make the next query to be somewhat in between. So it sort of is, you know, shifted from the original query towards the optimal query, except the optimal query is on a small, you know, it's a noisy estimate because it's only on 10 samples. That's exactly what this guy is doing here. So it's taking alpha times Q0 and beta times, you know, the centroid of the documents which are found to be relevant, and gamma times centroid of the documents which are found to be irrelevant. Okay? And the alpha must be basically, you know, alpha must be like 0.8 or something, 0.9 or something, so that you are still close to the original query. And you're just shifting it a little towards the relevant ones, away from the irrelevant ones. Okay? And as I said, one question is, in this case, how do beta and gamma affect the precision and recall? So the beta is here, gamma is here. How do beta and gamma affect the precision and recall? What? So if I increase beta, would the precision increase or reduce? What? If I increase gamma, would the precision increase or reduce? So this basically is stopping irrelevant documents from coming in. When the irrelevant documents come in, what goes down? What gets affected more? The precision. Recall doesn't matter. Recall, eventually everything has to be shown. So in fact, if you give all 8 billion documents as the answer to the user's query, recall is 100%. What went down is precision. Okay. So in fact, it would be nice to realize that the gamma is connected to the precision, and beta is connected to both precision and recall. Okay. Because in this sense, for example, by doing this, it could actually, for example, if the query was a particular word, let's say bush, but then the user started, you know, clicking on documents which have very few instances of the word bush, but many more instances of the word rose, then in essence, you are adding rose to the query. And that essentially increases the recall because he seems to be liking roses, even though the query just said bush. And so you will wind up getting the documents that the user likes, even though he or she did not actually specify that they liked them beforehand. Okay? So anyway, so it's worth looking at how this, you know, affects the precision and recall. But the bigger issue is you're essentially changing the query to take into account the relevance of the top 10 documents that were shown to you. Okay? So here is a little example. I won't even bother going through it. But one nice thing about all this is we are thinking of queries and documents in the same uniform representation. They're all vectors in the space of terms. So you can add up vectors, you can subtract vectors from each other, you can multiply vectors and take linear combinations of vectors. So that's one of the advantages that, you know, was possible here. Okay? And then, you know, so relevance feedback actually is known to improve results if only you can get people to actually provide the relevance judgment. One crazy thing that people actually use, I don't know whether I noticed it here, is as I said, if the user is actually in the loop, one of the issues is how do you get their, you know, feedback? What's the best way to get the feedback from the user without bugging them, saying, do you like it, do you like it? Okay. And as I said, one of the issues would be to do gaze, you know, recovery and see which results they seem to be looking more at. Another idea that actually some people have used, and this will be, we'll talk about this again towards the end of next class, is this idea called pseudo-relevance feedback. What pseudo-relevance feedback? Just ignore the user. Okay? So I run the query on my corpus, okay, the search engine, I get the top 10 results, then I just, like the Aesop's fable fox, assume that these 10 were the ones that the user wanted all along. Okay, so you cut the user out and you assume that the top 10 that you came up with are actually the top 10 most relevant results for the user. And now the next one, the next 10 when you are about to produce, you can essentially take these top 10 as relevant and do the beta times this centroid, add it to the alpha times the original query. You will get more results of the top 10 type in the next page. As weird as it sounds, actually, it has shown to work. It has been shown to work in some cases. Okay, we will talk about crazy ideas like this a little later too. For example, I'll just sort of mention it right now. So suppose one big issue between clustering and classification is, in the case of clustering, nobody needs to do anything before you start doing the work. They just give, the data is available, you just try to cluster it. In classification, they have to label the data. Okay, if the data is already labeled, it is stupid for the learner to not use the labels. If it's not labeled, it's kind of intransigent of the learner to say, oh, some people should just come and give me examples, okay, and get more of the labeled examples. Because labeling examples is going to be costly. In the case of relevant and irrelevant, some user has to look at a whole bunch of documents and say, yeah, these are relevant, these are irrelevant. And what are you paying them for doing all this work? Right? So the question then is, the unlabeled data in many cases is more freely available than the labeled data. Okay, so what about this crazy idea, which we'll come back to next class? Suppose I have billion documents, I only have 1,000 of them labeled. So using these 1,000 labeled documents, I learn what's the best way to classify a new document. Now I can go ahead and apply this classifier to billion minus 1,000, the extra documents that are available to me that have been not yet labeled. So I go ahead and classify them using the classifier I learned on the first 1,000 labeled documents. Now how many labeled documents do I have? Billion, right? Because I learned from the first the first 1,000, and then use the noisy learner that I have to classify the 1 billion minus 1,000 documents. And now I have billion documents labeled. So I now relearn what I want to learn from this labeled extra set of labeled documents. And then keep doing this until labels don't change. Could this be a good idea? This blows your mind. It looks as if you're doing nothing. Essentially, you're basically using your own ignorance. So it's like you have been given, this is the following case. I mean, I think you guys actually know this. So you're getting ready for the exam, and then you're in the grade school, and you have a bunch of worked out examples in the textbook, but there are also a whole bunch of other examples, other problems for which answers are not even available. Right? It's only available to the instructor. So now you solve the ones that you learned how to solve based on the few for which the answers are available. So those are the labeled examples. Based on that, you went ahead and solved some of the unlabeled examples. Now, is this going to be good or bad? You could have asked yourself. So if you actually misunderstood some concept, in looking at the examples, you would have just done that same thing the questions without solutions, and you would say, whatever solution I got is the right solution, and I spent some time thinking about the problem, so I should be in a better shape than the guy who did not do these extra problems, and who is going to do well in the test cases. Okay, and if you are too worried that your ignorance will just get amplified by working on unsolved problems, then you would only look at the solved problems and go to the exam. Okay? But most of you, I hope, if you are still here and you have actually, crossed through many exams, you know that actually that's a dumb idea. You should solve unsolved problems, even when you don't know what their answer is, because the very act of solving seems to help you. In fact, we will look at what that means from the classification point of view. What does it mean to use your noisy learner to label unlabeled data, and then now act as if it's all, you know, this. In fact, one of the things that again happens when you're looking for the exam is you try to solve one of these other problems. You may have gotten a solution. You have no clue whether that solution you got, which is 7.7, is that the right number or is it 18.9? You have no clue. But after having done 7.7, then you realize, oh, I noticed that in the seventh step, this trick is involved to get the answer. Now you have no clue whether the answer you got is correct or not. And yet you learned something about how to do problems faster. We do this all the time. Okay? The question is, using unlabeled examples, is that to actually increase the number of labeled examples, is that going to be helpful or not? You know, and it's a big idea right now because on the web, data is easy to get. There's tons and tons and tons of documents, but very few of them are actually labeled. So this web is sort of like, there's a huge, big math textbook, okay? Only 100 problems have been answered. You know, they have solutions available. But, you know, a billion extra problems have been formulated. Nobody tells you what their solutions are. The question you have to ask yourself is trying to work on those problems with your limited knowledge. Is that helpful or not? You know some of the answer already, right? Because many of you work on those problems. But would that be a reasonable thing to do in classification? We'll get to that. The only reason I brought that up is that is sort of like pseudo-relevance feedback. So without learning anything about what the user wants and based on just the user's query, you came up with the top 10 results. Now you decided that's what the answers are supposed to look like. So you assume that that's what is the top 10 real results, and then you do relevance feedback using that. And that actually can be useful sometimes, okay? And you need to understand why this kind of an idea works. I will bring this back next class, but you know, let it start bothering you in the back of your head. Okay, so the other idea, of course, about classification in terms of clustering is k-nearest neighbors. You take k-nearest neighbors. So you know, for the new document that's been given to you, you find among all the labeled examples, find the k examples that are closest to it in some distance. And then take their labels, and the majority label of the neighbor becomes your label. That's it. So I give you a new document, and I have given you some articles from Arizona Republic, some articles known to be from New York Times, some articles known to be from Arizona Republic. I gave you a new article. You did vector similarity with you know, all the numbers, all the documents here, all the documents here. Okay? You found this guy has, on the top 10 closest documents, 3 come from here, 7 come from here. Which means it has 7 Arizona Republic neighbors. So this is a document from Arizona Republic. That's what I would say. Okay, so you're kind of taking both the distance and the labels into account. Okay. So this now finally brings me to the question that I was hoping people will start discussing much more actively on the blog than they did, which is, if this is, you know, I already explained all about classification right now. You know, classification is clustering plus little extra labels. Should we bother about other types of classification techniques? And in what way is classification any harder than what I just told you, which is think in terms of clusters and distance between the new topic and the clusters, new data point and the clusters? There are many reasons, but two I would actually make you think about is, for example, there are two examples where just distances to the clusters may actually mislead you. Okay, for example, the first one is that the class labels may be describing essentially non-spherical clusters. Okay, that means essentially, so for example, I might be describing, I give you a whole bunch of towns in the United States, and I say these are the coastal towns, these are the non-coastal towns. So label one, label two. Now the point is, coastal towns are very close to a whole bunch of non-coastal towns, right? Every coast is just the edge, right? And they're close to a whole bunch of non-coastal towns, okay? So if you think in terms of centroids and et cetera, you won't necessarily get So basically the cluster right now is a very weird shape. I mean, so if you look at you know, migrate map of United States, and so there are cities here and here, those would be the coastal town cities, and then everything else is non-coastal. Now tell me a clustering algorithm which uses distances and will say somehow this is one cluster here, this is one cluster here. Notice that these two clusters are actually the same as far as labels are concerned, and everything in between is a separate cluster. Okay, and so any clustering algorithm which does basically geographic distance based stuff would essentially miss the point that it would not have any clusters that correspond purely to a specific label. So you make makeup clusters. You might, for example, make clusters saying here is northwest, here is northeast, here is southwest, here is southeast, here is the great unknown middle. Okay, and those are the clusters. Unfortunately, these clusters have no connection to the labels. In fact, the labels that I have basically combine a part of this cluster, a part of this cluster, a part of this cluster, and a part of this cluster, and say they are all one label. Everything else is another label. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's like when you make the clusters that naturally occurring clusters in the data may not have any connection to the labels that you have. Okay? It's also actually happened in this case too, that because the naturally occurring clusters may not connect to the labels, it may well be that they will wind up taking two clusters and say they both have the same label. In this particular case, if I have this piece of the cluster, this piece of the cluster, this piece and this piece has the same label. The picture that I painted last class was somehow you come up with two clusters and one cluster corresponds to one label, another cluster corresponds to another label, and then you get a new topic, a new data point. You just need to figure out which one is it closest to in terms of either the centroids or the neighbors. That's just not going to work well. Now, having said this, is this really a problem? So the reason this becomes, different question after looking at this is this really a problem only for classification? Or should that be also a problem for clustering? I mean, my question is, if I did not ever tell you any labels, would there not have been any reasonable way of thinking that these cities form a cluster together? In US, of course, there is. In fact, clustering is any grouping. Okay? The problem was, as I mentioned, and you probably thought I was a madman when I kept saying that clustering depends on the distance, and the biggest mistake you make, the biggest assumption you make is to decide which is the dimensionality of, what is the space in which these points become, you know, each example becomes a point. The moment I decided to look at US map in terms of the XY coordinates of the cities, I am considering the Euclidean distance, but it would only capture clusters in that space. Okay? What if I actually should be defining each of these cities in terms of their weather, in terms of whether or not they have ocean next to them, in terms of their terrain, etc.? Then it will be a much larger space, where XY coordinates would be two of the features. There will be many other features. Now when you start looking at the distances in those spaces, there may indeed be natural clusters corresponding to putting these guys in one cluster. Okay? Now why wasn't that a problem for us in clustering? Because clustering is posed as an unsupervised learning problem. So nobody is supposed to know the answer, not you, not the teacher, right? So it's like biologists give you a whole bunch of data, let's say microarrays or something, and say, find some patterns in this, okay? You find patterns. The question is, do they know if the pattern that you found is right or wrong? They don't either. So the teacher knows no more than the student, the student here being the learner. Okay, so if I just give you the data, you put it in some space and you look for clusters in that. And are there other kinds of clusterings? Yes, of course there are other kinds of clusterings. I can put this in a different space and I'll get different clusters. Is this the right clustering or not? How do I know? And I can ask my teacher, do you know? And the teacher would say, I don't know either. Because truly unsupervised means they don't know what the clusters are. And you don't know what the clusters are. You're just finding, you know, some reasonable approximation. Okay, just a second. Whereas in the classification, the teacher actually knows something. The teacher told you that, look, here is the data about US cities. Now the US map looks really ununderstandable. So I'll put this. So here is the map of the US, and here are the cities in this. And look, I don't care exactly how you represent them, but I want to say that cities 1, 7, 8, 9, and 15 are having label 1. They're called coastal cities. And the cities, you know, 25, 39, 47, 55 are label 2. They're called non-coastal cities. Now you decide to put these points in whatever space you want such that you will actually see them as clusters. Do you understand what I'm saying? So previously all that mattered was whether you had nice and shiny, internally high quality clusters. And they could exist in different spaces, and you just picked one space and you found the clusters and you said, I'm done there. Now, and there was no way of checking whether you're right or wrong. There was no way of checking whether you're right or wrong because nobody else knows any better than you do. But in the case of classification, I'm giving you the labels, and so after making the clusters, you need to check whether in fact the clusters respect the labels. If not, then you know, you find a different space where you can actually find clusters that respect the labels. This is basically the reason why classification actually can be much more interesting, because somebody knows something and that basically puts a constraint on the space in which you should view these points. If they're not becoming naturally occurring clusters in the space you thought of first, which is the XY coordinates, then find features which will distinguish them, right? And then many a time you will start making, you know, funny features which just somehow seem to be, you know, they seem to actually, so you have to come up with other features where in which this actually becomes separated clusters. Yeah, there was a question here.
Mm-hmm. One more dimension to it, which is the label you gave me. Is that saying like every classification problem is essentially a clustering problem with an extra label?
That's what I'm asking you to think about as.
Right, it seems to me it's just equal. I mean, if these two are the same, so.
No, I'm not sure what I.
Okay, well, I'm saying that is true. If we think of the label as one extra dimension, then every cluster.
Yeah, but except if you make the label itself as a dimension, then it's useless, because the test data should come with whether or not it's a coastal city or not. So there is no question for you to answer. In fact, this is actually what people wound up doing. So, you know, here are all the bunch of students, right? And then I came up with their, hair color and the shirt color, and then I put them in my space. And then I know who's getting 4.0 GPS and who's getting 1.2 GPS. You know, that's the extra information they've been given. That's been given to me. Now I said 4.0 good, 1.2 bad GPA, let's say. So the bad GPA students, good GPA students. Now I'm trying to explain, given a new student, are they likely to have good GPA or bad GPA? Your idea is to make GPA one of the dimensions. Of course, if I do that, then I can ask the next student you give me, tell me their GPA. What you're really looking for is there any naturally occurring features of the data? Now, currently, the best naturally occurring features I could find is the hair color and the shirt size. Okay? Can I find other features that seem to be correlated with the way the label is there, with the way the label is? And then those are the ones that are measurable. If, in fact, the label itself is part of the data, then there is no learning to be done. It's like asking, here is an n-dimensional point, x1 to xn dimensions, and I give you a new point, which is 10,000 dimensional point, and I'm asking you, what is its 15th dimension? You look it up. I gave you all the dimensions. What's interesting is, the label is an extra dimension that's not given to the test case. So you have to find how the other dimensions are correlated with the label.
So we're saying if this extra dimension could actually be produced based on some linear or nonlinear combination of the rest of the dimensions.
Exactly.
Then we can actually take it that there is a missing dimension for the testing data.
That's true. So the point is you are now increasing that, you are in some sense finding the relevant dimensions for the data. So by doing this discussion, we are saying you need to find the relevant dimensions of the data that will be correctly correlated with the labeling that has been given to the data. Okay? This could sometimes mean ignoring a whole bunch of noisy dimensions. So for example, if in fact I'm giving you 1,000 dimensional data, but the label seems to be just checking whether or not the 15th dimension is positive or negative. That's it. That's what label is. Then in fact, realizing that 999 dimensions of the data are completely irrelevant is a very big thing, because any natural clustering would have tried to work in the 1,000 dimensional space, and the clusters in the 1,000 dimensional space, while they are clusters, may not have any correlation to the labeled cluster. So in that case, you reduce the dimensions. And sometimes you actually have to increase the dimensions. Okay? And so that's basically, again, these are the more, and all these problems exist for clustering. All these problems exist for clustering. It's just that nobody is going to yell at you because nobody knows any better than you do. Do you understand what I'm saying? Suppose, I give you an exam, so I give you on the exam questions. If I don't know the answer, what can I say about what you wrote as the answers to those questions? You can come and say, you don't know the answer, I don't know the answer, at least I wrote it cleanly. So you should give me full points. And I have to agree. That's what clustering does. You don't know what the clusters are, I don't know what the clusters are, but at least my clusters are nice, shiny, and spherical. And this other guy's clusters are, funny looking. So give me points, and you have to give points. Okay? Again, this is beyond just this class. It's a question of classification versus clustering, and how do they differ? By giving extra knowledge, you're putting constraints, and those constraints are essentially on the dimensions in which the point is being represented. It could be reducing the dimensionality, it could be increasing first and then reducing the dimensionality. Both of them are possible. In the case of the US, if all I had was X and Y, there was no nonlinear combination of X and Y, it turns out, which would capture, for example, whether or not, what is the terrain in that area, for example, unless you have some additional information. Okay? Okay, so that's the reason why clustering methods are not enough, even though this is so much simpler to do. And so to the extent the labels are not well correlated with the distance-based clusters that you get, then you have to find which dimensions are important, which additional dimensions need to be added, etc. That's why classification becomes interesting. And of course, for a few seconds now, for a few minutes now, let's think not about text documents, but this other completely different example, which some of you have probably seen from AI class, right? This is Russell's restaurant eating habits. Here are a bunch of training examples where Russell, has gone to a restaurant and decided, having looked at the restaurant situation, whether or not he's going to wait to be seated. Okay, so we go through this situation too. Sometimes you go to a restaurant and you may want to wait, you may not want to wait, depending on how much wait is, how many people are already there, how good looking they are, and all this fun stuff, right? So basically, he decided to look at his restaurant examples in terms of whether there is an alternative, whether there is a bar in the restaurant, is it a Friday, blah blah blah, all sorts of features. And for each feature, there is a valuation. Okay, and then finally, this is the training data. In this training data, in this case, he decided to stay. In this case, he decided to stay. In this case, he decided to stay. That means wait for the table. At the other cases, he decided not to wait for the table. Okay, so in this, to the extent I assume these are the dimensions for the data, in the, so this is what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. In this 9 dimensional space, in this 9 dimensional space, I have to find 2 clusters in this 9 dimensional space, which make natural sense in terms of the distances, and which also have these labels. So the one cluster has all the S labels and one cluster has all the no labels. Now, you know, it turns out that in doing these kinds of problems, as I said, you are essentially looking for, both looking for the reduced dimensionality or looking for increased dimensionality. So find the right set of dimensions that are correctly correlated with the data, with the labels. And there's a whole bunch of learning algorithms. I'm not going to go into all of them, but probably even before you came here, you heard about probably decision tree learning, you heard about association rule mining, you heard about Bayes network learning, maybe, may not, but at least we will talk about this one, and you may have heard about neural network learning. In all these cases, what you wind up doing is you essentially assume a particular form for the representation of the hypothesis, a function which will take the new data point and will say yes or no. And if this function says yes, then the data point actually belongs to the label 1. If it says no, it belongs to label 2. And you know, you can generalize it to multi-class label problems. The question, of course, is you know, the form of the function changes. In this case, the function is a Bayes network. In this case, the function is a decision tree. Here, it is a neural network. Here, it's a bunch of association rules. The question is, which one of these should we talk about for our case? Okay, for every algorithm, every kind of classification out there, the cluster-based ideas, the ones that I've already discussed, they will work. But they probably could be completely wrong if, in fact, the labeling has no correlation with the natural distance measure. Like what happened there. Okay, so if I was going to look at you know, this function learning, then which kind of a function should I learn? And actually, we will, of these, we will look at naive Bayes classifier as the one that we will look at. But the important reason is the following. One important issue is, if you think about decision tree learners, they work best. Decision tree learners, for those of you who have never heard of decision tree learners, it is, I get to ask you 20 questions. And based on your answers, I decide. For the test case that comes up, I get to ask 20 questions on the test case, and based on the questions, answers to those questions, I decide the label of that data point. Okay, the questions have to be simple questions, such as what is your 15th dimension? What is your 19th dimension? Is your 19th dimension greater than 5? Is your 15th dimension positive or negative? Things like that. Okay, now decision tree learners would be the, would work best if there is one critical question that separates the good guys from the bad guys, or a few critical questions that separate the good guys from the bad guys. Okay, for those of you who remember the intro to AI discussion, you know that a classic bad example for decision tree learning is what? Majority, finding majority or finding parity, where you have to ask questions on every one of the dimensions of the data. Because unfortunately, the reason we actually have to show up and vote is because even one vote can change the race, even though most of the time it doesn't. You know, to actually figure out who won the election, in the worst case, you have to look at all the preferences of all the people. In such a case, the decision tree will wind up asking questions corresponding to each one of the dimensions. Okay? And that time, it doesn't converge fast. It takes a long time to learn such a decision tree. Okay, decision trees work very well when there is, you can ask one or two questions and answers to those just differentiate the two labels. Remember, one possibility in which classification could be different from clustering is I have a 1,000 dimensional data point, but the labels only depend on the 15th dimension. If it is 15th dimension is positive, I say it's a positive example, otherwise it's a negative example. In such a case, decision tree will find the most discriminating dimension very quickly, and it will have a very simple hypothesis. So the function will be, you know, what's your 15th dimension? Okay, so in fact, so decision tree learners use, I mean, I guess probably at least one guy here should know, shibboleths. Who knows shibboleths? You should know. Don't you know? Shibboleth is this English word. I'm told actually that it's basically a code word, and at one time, Hebrews and non-Hebrews were having a war, and they would decide whether or not somebody is a Hebrew of Jewish faith based on whether or not they can say Shibboleth. And the guys who are not Jews would say Sibboleth, I believe, and the ones who are Jews would say Shibboleth. And presumably, I could be missing it. Based on just that one question, you get to either live or die. Right? So decision tree learners work well when there are good shibboleths to differentiate. This was done in Germany during Second World War II, I think. You would ask, presumably, what's the top song today in Midwest? And, if you're from US, you would know the answer, otherwise you won't, and they can kill you. Okay, so decision trees are great for, shibboleth, sort of scenarios where there's a few dimensions that differentiate the classes. Now, is that true for text classification? Think of a classic text classification scenario, which is the mail a spam mail or not a spam mail? Okay, it would be extremely easy if everybody agrees to a convention saying they will use a particular word, let's say Viagra, right, in every spam mail, and they won't use it in every non-spam mail. In that case, decision tree will just ask that question and say spam, non-spam. Most text classification scenarios, what happens is all the dimensions wind up being relevant, but to varying degrees of relevance. So what makes something a spam versus non-spam mail is not just one single word, but a collective combination of many, many spammy words in it, and the lack of many, many non-spam indicators in it. Okay? In those cases, actually, it turns out decision tree kind of learners are useless, because they will wind up having to look at each of the dimensions, and so they take a long time to learn. Okay? From a learner's complexity point of view, you guys know what the answer is in some sense, but what does it mean to say a learning algorithm is, a learner is a bad learner? What it means is that learner requires a large number of examples before they can learn the concept. Okay? So somebody who can learn the classification with 10 examples and then start doing well in the test versus somebody who needs, many more examples before doing well on the test. Okay, so decision tree learners would take lot more examples to do well in these kinds of scenarios where multiple dimensions wind up being relevant except to different degrees of relevance. There are other kinds of ones, for example, perceptron learning and in fact naive Bayes classifier, which actually do much better in these cases where everybody is possibly relevant. And what you'd wind up doing is you'd add up all their relevance and see which one, whether or not it tips the scale in one class's favor versus other class. Okay? So that's the long reason and as to why actually we will look at, the only learning algorithm we will look at in today's class, today's and the next class, is naive Bayes classifier. Okay? And we wouldn't do, because that winds up being a very useful kind of learning algorithm. Any high bias algorithm which does not depend on very few dimensions making all the difference is a good learning algorithm for text data because of the applications that you have in mind, where multiple dimensions wind up deciding the label of the data. Okay. So let's see what I can do in 15 minutes for naive Bayes classifier, and then you get to think about it, and then we will wrap it up next time, and then we'll do recommendation system. Okay, so what's naive Bayes classifier? What it's trying to do is, it does not think in terms of clusters directly, at least. What you have is, I would do this, so I have a bunch of examples, E1 to EN, all of which are defined in terms of A1 to AK attributes. Okay? So each example is in terms of the attribute. So this picture is very nicely connected to the Russell scenario. But when we actually think of these examples as text data, then these attributes will be the words. And the value of the attribute would be how many times that word is present in the document. Okay? So it's really quite relevant for us. So And these examples, for each of these examples, there is a class where I would say, okay, example E1 belongs to class CI, this one belongs to class CJ, etc. So for the training examples, I told you what the classes are. Then what I am trying to find out is, given a new test example whose attributes I know, whose attribute valuations I know, for example, a new document whose words I know, I'm trying to decide what class it's likely to belong to. Okay? And what we would try to do is we would try to act as if we do this as a probabilistic inference problem. Okay? And so so E has k attributes, A1 to AK, and each AI can take D different values, let's assume. Okay, maximum. Now, the Bayes classification, the probabilistic classification says, assign E to the class CI that maximizes this probability. Probability that if the example has the following attribute values, then it belongs to CI class. This is the probability that you are trying to compute. And if you estimated for the new example, the probabilities for each of the classes, whichever has the highest value, that's the one that you would say this belongs to. In fact, naive Bayes classification also allows, in some sense, fractional membership. You can actually say that this example belongs to all these classes with these different probabilities. You can either pick up one class, or you can actually say this is the distribution of the membership of this example to the different classes. Okay, now, so the only reason we look at the word Bayes is that in trying to compute probability of class given examples, you write that using the Bayes rule, probability of example given class times probability of class by probability of example. Okay, I think most of you should know what I'm doing there, but if you don't, then it's not that hard to understand Bayes rule. It's basically probability of A given B according to just rules of probability is probability of A and B by probability of B. Right? And similarly, probability of B given A is probability of A and B by probability of A. And all that Bayes rule does is to realize that if you take this here, probability of B times probability of A given B will be probability of A and B. And similarly, if you take this here, probability of A times probability of B given A is again probability of A and B. So these two are equal. So then, if I'm given this, I can compute this by saying probability of B given A is probability of A given B times probability of B by probability of A. That's what I just wrote there. Okay? So rather than what I'm interested in is computing the probability that the example belongs to the class CI, and I rewrite it as in terms of probability that if you belong to class CI, the example would have this description, times probability of the class CI itself. That means how likely is it that a random example will belong to class CI. And then similarly, and this is probability of E, which is the prior probability that this such an example is actually present at all. Okay. Now, it turns out that first thing we know is, now, if we know these numbers, then I can compute this. And I'm done. The problem is these numbers are not available. You need to compute these numbers from the data. All you have is that, for example, Russell example where the training examples, their descriptions in terms of the attributes and their final classification. That's all you have. From them, you need to compute these numbers. Okay. Now, in doing this, first of all, you have to realize that among the numbers here, this number I don't really need. Why? Because if I were to compute probability of C1, probability that the example, test example belongs to C1 and test example belongs to C2, both of them would be dependent on the same P of E. So they cancel out. So essentially, whichever number is bigger, you just pick that. So, you know, you can get by without ever knowing this. unless you are really interested in the probability rather than which class it belongs to, you just need these numbers. Of these numbers, this is easy. Probability that a random example belongs to class I, you could just say that is nothing but in the training examples. In the case of Russell, you know, what are the classes? Yes, he will wait. No, he won't wait. Now, if I go back to my example, there were 6 times Russell waited, 6 times Russell didn't wait. So the probability that a random example would be a waiting example would be 50%, 0.5, and no would be 0.52. You can just count this by looking at this data. Okay. The only thing I need is the only other thing I need is this probability of example, given that I tell you it belongs to class CI. Okay, and to do this, it turns out that the problem, of course, is an example E is defined as A1 has V1 and A2 has V2, etc. Vk has Vk. That's an example. Okay. So how many possible examples are there? Since each attribute can take d different values, so there is d possibilities here, d possibilities here, d possibilities here. Okay. So the number of examples are d power k. Number of total examples, total possible examples in this dimension, in this space, is d power k. So for each class, I would need d power k numbers that a particular example belongs to that class. Okay. Now for the Russell data, I said there were how many dimensions were there? Russell data 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 dimensions actually. 10 dimensions were there. So for each class, I need And assume that for a minute that they're all Boolean. They're not actually Boolean. Let's assume they're just Boolean because that's easier to do. Then you need 2 power 10 numbers per class. 2 power 10 numbers per class. That means, and there are two classes. So you need 2,048 numbers have to be wrung out. 2,048 numbers have to be wrung out. And I have how many examples do I have? 12 examples. You can make these examples, but most of them will wind up being zero. And they will be totally wrong estimates. In statistical learning, in learning in general, the biggest problem is the more the parameters you need to learn, the larger the amount of data you need to actually learn them with any accuracy. Do you understand what I'm saying? So for example, I could easily make an X13 which doesn't belong to any of the existing X1 to X12. Then I ask you, what is the probability that it belongs to will wait class? If I tell you it will wait, right? What's the probability that it actually belongs to that class? I can't tell because you didn't give me an example like that before. Okay? So instead, what we will wind up doing, instead of computing 2048 numbers, I make a huge assumption. I make the assumption that probability of an example given class, which is probability of this whole thing given class CI, I will say that the way the data is generated is I will first decide the class label, and then the class label decides A1, A2, AK. That's my assumption about how the data is generated. If I do that, then those of you who know Bayes networks can understand what I just say, but others take it on faith, that in essence what I'm saying is, once class label is decided, the attribute values are all independent of each other. That's what this Bayes network structure is saying. Okay? Once that is the case, then this probability can just be written as probability of A1 equal to V1 given Ci times probability of A2 equal to V2 given Ci. That's it. Now you might say, well, previously I didn't have to do multiplication, now I have to do multiplication, it's more painful. But that's what you would say if you're in grade 1, okay, because you don't like multiplication. For us, multiplication is not a problem. The problem is how many numbers you need to compute this way. This way, I need to compute really, if these are all Boolean attributes, I would say I just need k numbers per class. K numbers per class instead of 2 power k numbers per class. These numbers are the probabilities. Much fewer numbers that I need to assess. Of course, those numbers would be actually correct numbers if this huge assumption is right, that all the attributes are independent given the class. Let's think about what this means for text data. Remember, for attributes for the text data are words, right? What is the class? The simplest would be spam, non-spam, or relevant, irrelevant. All I am saying is, once I tell you that this is a relevant document, then the probability, I mean, sorry, let's say, once I tell you that this is a spam mail, the probability that the word Viagra exists in this mail is independent of the probability that the word, treatment exists in this mail. Okay? Obviously, if it's a non-spam mail, these probabilities still need to be computed, but they're different. So, in a non-spam mail, the probability that Viagra exists, let's say, is 0.1. And the spam mail probability that the Viagra exists is 0.7. That's okay. The bigger issue is Viagra is going to be independent of the word treatment given the class. That means you are assuming keywords are independent, terms are independent. Is this a new assumption we are making? No, we did this all along. In fact, the entire idea of looking at documents as vectors in n-dimensional space where the dimensions are the keywords and acting as if all the dimensions are completely orthogonal to each other meant that keywords are already orthogonal to each other. Okay? Now, of course, you know that that was a mistaken assumption. Sometimes it can come and haunt you. This also can come and haunt you. But you're not making any more. In fact, you're making little less than before. Now you're only saying things are independent, keywords are independent given the class name. Okay? So, if I do that, then basically, this is what I was saying. So, estimating PE given CI is harder because it requires these kinds of numbers, and if assuming D values for attribute, you will need, and there are N classes, you will need N times D power K probabilities. Okay? Learning is hard exactly when I give you one example and from that I expect you to learn 1,000 parameters. Okay, because the estimates would be completely off. Okay? So then we decided to make the naive Bayes assumption which says class determines all the attributes independently of each other. Okay, in which case probability of E given Ci is just a big product of probability that ith attribute takes jth value given the class name. This reduces the number of numbers you need to compute from the data. And each of these numbers now can just be computed from the data. Okay, in the last 5 minutes, I'm just going to show you. Now, as I said, connecting this to the documents and keywords, this assumption is bogus most of the time. You made this assumption so that your life would be easy. But the assumption of independence of attributes is just the same as assumption of independence of keywords, which you made and got along up to this point in the class. Okay? And so you could get along some more time. Okay? But what's interesting is many a time this seems to work well. It actually makes the learning possible. That means you can learn these numbers with much fewer examples because you need to learn much fewer numbers to begin with. And secondly, they seem to be quite correct in deciding the class label. Okay? What I want to do is show how that works on how do you get those numbers on the Russell example. Okay? And, actually, let me show you the example. and then you can go back and make sure that you understand the numbers. If not, we'll go over them again next class. Okay. So all I have is I'm trying to compute for this training data, I'm trying to compute the naive Bayes probabilities. The probabilities would be of the following type. Will weight equal to yes? Prior probability that the class is yes. That would be 6 over 12 because there are a total of 12 examples, 6 of them are yes. So 6 over 12. The next one that I want is probabilities of this type. The probability that the patterns attribute will have the value full when the class is yes. Right? That's the kind of numbers I need. So how do I do this? First find out all the class yes. All the red guys are the class yes. That's going to be in the denominator. And then look at the patterns attribute and see how many of the red ones is it full. And if you count, it's some here, it is some here, and then there's a full here, and then there's a full here, and a full here. Right? No, I'm sorry, no, two actually. This is patterns equal to full, will weight equal to yes. Of these red rows, there is a full here, this row has a full, and then where else is a full? There is a full here. That's it. 2 over 6. Similarly, if you ask probability of patterns equal to sum given will weight equal to yes, that would be 4 over 6. This is very easy. Basically, you're looking at the data, you're just taking simple ratios. Okay? Except the number of ratios you need to take is now going to be just proportional to the number of attributes rather than being proportional to exponential. Instead of being exponential in the number of attributes, now the probabilities that you're computing, the number of probabilities that you're computing are only linear in the number of attributes. Okay, if I have all these numbers, then Bayes rule already tells me. Remember, in fact, we already know how to compute probability of given an example, the probability that it belongs to class CI is nothing but probability that this example belongs to this class times prior probability of the class multiplied by some normalizing constant, which is the same for all the classes. So if I find this number for class 1 and class 2, both of which are multiplied by the same alpha, which is 1 over PE, then whichever is bigger, that's the one that's going to win, ignoring alpha. Right? And then PE given CI is being written as probability of attribute 1 having this value given C1, probability of attribute 2 having this value given C1, and so on. All these numbers you have already computed and stored given the data. Okay, if you were doing this for text, you would do the exact same thing, except instead of attributes, you are counting the words. Each word becomes an attribute. Okay, this is basically naive Bayes classification. And what's interesting is it works extremely well, even though you're making very bad assumption that class determines all the attributes. Okay. What that means is, because of that assumption, the posterior distribution that naive Bayes classifier computes is quite far from the true posterior distribution. That means the true posterior distribution for a class, a particular example, if people knew exactly what the ideal values were, for an example, you might realize that it belongs to yes with 0.57 and no with 0.43 probability. That's the true values. Naive Bayes might actually say this is 0.92, this is 0.08. These numbers are hugely different. The probabilities are completely different. But what you really care is which one is more likely. They're coming to the same exact answer. So there's a lot of leeway when all you need to decide is which class wins rather than what's the true probability. Okay, and that's one of the reasons why naive Bayes actually winds up working quite well in practice. So we'll come back next class, review this, talk about the Unigram text model, and get into recommendation system.